verse 12, where Paul looks at another group, and this is much more difficult. Well, no, it's not more difficult, it's more subtle. It's not as straightforward. He's now dealing in verse 12 with those who are married, but one of them is not a believer. And once again, if I could only say to you, and I wish the church was doing it too, taking a baptism certificate to be an identification of a believer strikes me as systemically easy, profoundly unhelpful. Because belief is a matter of values, it's a matter of ways of looking at life, it's a matter of love, it's a matter of prayer, you know. And you can be with a baptized woman or man who has none of those things and doesn't believe anything. So I just want to make sure you notice what Paul's talking about. Right, let's see what he has to say about this. To the rest, in other words, not those who are married believers, to the rest I say, I am not the Lord. There's a lovely distinction, and we've got to keep making that distinction. And in church teaching, we're making it all the time. The theologians have got quite subtle range, like 10 or so categories of how faith is to be given to documents of varying importance. And for the ordinary person, let's say, I guess most of us, without that subtlety, you think, well, church says this, the church says that, the church says that, they all end up in the one basket as equally important, and they're not meant to be. So Paul doesn't want this to be taken as seriously as what he's just said. He says, I say this, but not the Lord. I haven't got anything from Jesus on it, and there's nothing in the tradition, but Paul's living in that real world of Corinth, and he's come up with this bit of wisdom, which he's offering as best he may, and he's not saying it's the last word. He's not that silly. If a believer has a wife who is an unbeliever, and she consents to live with him, and don't underestimate the depth of the word live, to live with him, well, he shouldn't divorce her. Go back to the question. The question is, where does celibacy fit into all this? Do I have to be celibate to be a Christian? And here's a married woman whose husband is a pagan going off to wherever. And she's saying, well, it's a good thing to be separate, but let's have a look at this. Even though your husband is not a Christian, or your wife is not a Christian, though the other is more likely, I think, because mostly, if a wife made a decision to become a Christian, that's a pretty strong thing to do. If a man became a Christian, it would be fairly normal for his wife to come along with him, because it's part of the kind of understanding and system, and maybe even, you know, today it might be the other way, but I hope you can follow the customs of the time. Usually everyone went with the head of the house. But whichever way, if a believer has a wife who is an unbeliever and she consents to live with him, he shouldn't divorce her. And if a woman has a husband who is an unbeliever and he consents to live with her, she shouldn't divorce him. Don't go and live a celibate life. You're married, and okay, and this is his reason. The unbelieving husband is made holy through his wife, and the unbelieving wife is made holy through her husband. Otherwise your children would be unclean, but as it is, they're holy. But, here's the but, if the unbelieving partner separates after her, or consider yourself married to the end of your life, if the marriage relationship is broken by the unbelieving partner, in such a case, the brother or sister is not bound, and that's always been understood, I think, correctly. You're not bound by that marriage. In fact, you're free to marry a Christian. So you're not bound. Look at his beautiful reason. Gee, I wish this was put in great big headlines in Catholic schools everywhere. It is to peace that God has called you. I've put the capital letters, but Paul has too. He just didn't write it that way. It's to peace that God has called you. Now, that's deep. It's quite profound. I'll say some things about it in a moment. But this is his end to that whole thing. Wife, he says, for all you know, you might save your husband. Husband, for all you know, you might save your wife. Your love for him, your love for her, your fidelity to marriage, even though he doesn't believe with you, you may win him over, and he may come to believe, you know, through your love. So he's certainly saying, don't automatically think the whole thing's broken just because you don't share your faith. You don't have to become celibate. and you don't have to break. If he breaks or she breaks from you, he doesn't say what would happen if you broke from him. He just doesn't go into that. He hasn't got an opinion on it in this passage. He doesn't talk about it anywhere else. But what he said is what he said, and I hope it's clear. I want to read for you what I've offered you in that handout now. But I'll do something first, and then I'll come to that. Because I've tried to have a deeper look at what Paul is saying. But just before that, let's see what I've got here for you. We're looking at a situation where one of the partners is not a Christian. That's clear. According to Matthew, whom I gave you a bit earlier, Jesus' words don't apply to marriages that have been contracted outside the laws governing the Jewish community, laws which applied also to non-Jews living in the land, and you can find that in the book of Leviticus. So Matthew, we've already seen, qualifies it. Paul is dealing with people affected by Corinthian law, which allowed either party to divorce simply by making a declaration before witnesses and registering the fact. If the Christian spouse was divorced by his or her non-Christian spouse, what was to be done? That's the question. Was remarriage possible for the Christian? Alternatively, this is what they must have been asking in the thing, how does a person committed to the gospel live in a marriage relationship with a spouse who is not committed to it? Good questions. Is the Christian obliged to divorce? Is he or she permitted to divorce? In his earlier letter, Paul had told the community not to associate with sexually immoral persons. He mentions that in chapter 5, verse 9, when he says, in my earlier letter I said this, but they misunderstood it. Are they asking him, well, if I'm not allowed to associate with an immoral person, what about if my husband is an immoral person not living by Christian values? What about if my wife is? What do I do? Do I have to dissociate myself from him or her? Paul states that he has no teaching from Jesus on the matter. His judgment is that a Christian is not obliged to divorce. Not obliged to divorce. On the contrary, if the non-Christian partner does not instigate the divorce and consents to live with the Christian in peace, it's a big word, peace is shalom, peace is where who you are is loved, peace is where your love is actually fruitful. We all know what peace is, and something we love and something that isn't always around, and not all marriages, some marriages have very little of it. So we better look at this pretty carefully. He's talking about peace. Well, if there is peace, the Christian should continue in the marriage. Just as the children of a Christian who are too young to believe are drawn into the ambit of the Spirit, holy, by the believing parent, and we see so much of that, so also is the unbelieving spouse. The Christian may well be God's instrument in bringing about the salvation of the unbelieving spouse. That's Paul's feeling on it. If, however, the Christian partner is divorced by the unbelieving spouse, he or she is free to remarry, not bound by that marriage. Now, the notes that I've offered you, I might read them if I may. And you might want to comment on them next week if you wish. Paul doesn't claim to be covering every eventuality or to have the last word on such a complex matter. What was to happen when a believing spouse gave up the faith, in fact, if not in theory, and made it impossible for the believing spouse to live his or her faith or to experience peace in the marriage? Into what category would such a marriage fall? A marriage between believers, or a marriage between people who were believers but one is no longer a believer? Therefore, into the second category, because belief is about attitudes, life. There's no substitute for doing, I suggest, this is all me now, take no notice of it, it's not nothing official, but it's the best I can offer. There's no substitute for doing what Paul himself does in this passage. One must examine the actual relationship in the light of the nature of Christian marriage as a sacrament of God's unfailing love, and attempt a wise, compassionate, and realistic discernment, remembering, as Paul says, that it is to peace that God has called you. Fidelity to love can mean the cross. This has been a central theme of the letter. But not every cross is redemptive. Nor can remaining in an unloving relationship which is destructive be described as being faithful to love. It's a big thing to say. I think it's true. Each community and each married person has to enter into a careful and honest spiritual discernment in this matter. It's clear that Jesus is demanding a fidelity to marriage and a commitment to pledged love that goes beyond the expectation of his contemporaries, of whatever school of thought. Jesus doesn't compromise. Where there has been a genuine commitment of love between two people who have embraced the good news, breaking this commitment comes under the condemnation of adultery. Of course, people with the best will in the world make commitments which prove to be impossible to keep for any number of reasons. Where the commitment, however, is genuine, and where faith values are shared and peace enjoyed, an arbitrary decision to renounce the commitment is a breaking of faith. Keeping faith can, in some circumstances, demand heroic love, a love that is possible only through grace. It can mean dying to oneself. But we mustn't lose sight of Jesus' teaching that such dying does issue in life. Keep remembering, for me, an image is a good one. There were three crosses on Calvary. The one in the middle saved me. The other two didn't. So crosses aren't necessarily good. I've got to be pretty discerning. A cross in which someone is loving and able to grow through love, even in a most desperate situation, is very beautiful. And I think we all know people who are in such situations, and we can only just really admire them. A cross which is destructive of the person, where they're becoming less loving, less able to, we've got to look at it really, really carefully. Being a disciple of Jesus doesn't protect a person against the ordinary situations of hurt or misunderstanding or being a victim of another person's infidelity that are part of the human condition. The fact that two disciples of Jesus pledge their love to each other in faith doesn't guarantee them against marriage breakdown. Love doesn't control, and one partner cannot prevent the sin or the infidelity or the breaking of the covenant by the other. You can't prevent it. In Jesus' world, as in our own, it was all too easy to break the marriage covenant and to seek in another relationship the happiness one failed to find in marriage. If a marriage is destructive, this may be an appropriate answer. Jesus' words, however, stand as a warning against a too easy neglect of one's obligations. Some suffering is destructive. To undergo it has no merit and no reward. Some suffering, however, is redemptive. The latter is revealed by its fruit, a deepening of love. And better than all that, just to complete this aspect of Paul's writing, I want to read to you from John Hosey, a Marist in Sydney, who spent all his priestly life really working with people in broken relational situations. He's a very lovely man, but he also writes very well. And he's written this book, An Introduction to Catholics, Divorce and Remarriage, in 1990. And this is what he says. And I just offer it to you for your reflection too. It strikes me as one of the best things I've read on the matter. Divorce is about defeat and failure. It can be about victory and success. It's about pain and grief. It's also about healing and forgiveness and peace. It's about rejection. It can also be about acceptance. It's about the loss of hopes and the end of dreams. It can also be about new life, new hopes and new dreams. Often, it is about continuing grief over children who are always separated from one parent or the other and who doubt that they are part of a family anymore. It can also be about pride in children who are more mature and more together than their peers, and about single-parent homes which are more united, more peaceful, and more loving than many two-parent homes. In a word, divorce is about death. It can also be about resurrection. And he concludes this little part that I've chosen for you. It seems incredible to me that any Christian church could fail to see Christ in the divorced. And yet I'm aware that one of the greatest pains for Catholics who are divorced has been the message that they've received. He's not saying it was the message intended. The message they've received that there's no place for them in the Catholic Church. I've met many like that, and you've just got to love them to realise they've got it wrong. In trying to maintain its commitment to the idea which Jesus Christ put before us, the indissolubility of marriage, we lost sight of the reality. All of us fail. All of us need pardon and forgiveness. It was to the outcasts, to people who had failed, that Christ offered his special love and compassion. He showed little respect for the Pharisees. When we as a church have made outcasts of people who may be more the victims of divorce than its champions, who are the Pharisees? What Christ offered to us by his word and example was the promise that we too can overcome death as he did and live again and love again. His book goes into fine distinctions that aren't made there, of course, but the feeling of that is a good one for us, I believe, for us all to at least start from there. Another man who, well, many, but here's Kevin Kelly, who's written a book called Divorce and Second Marriage, and a small quote from him. A challenge to couples to recognize that growth in fidelity will only normally occur through phases of crisis. And that in a very special way in their marriage, each will have to live the gospel invitation of losing self in order to find the true self. Any of you who have been married for more than 6 months will know that that's true. This inner conviction of faith that the cross which leads to new life will be experience within marriage should provide the inner strength and conviction to keep going in time of darkness. The only point I'm offering you, the point that John Hosey is making and that everyone makes, I guess, hopefully, is that when a person is suffering in a relationship, they need incredible love, incredible wisdom. They need to know the values of the community that have come to them, but they mustn't be rigid. They must be exploratory to see what is the real situation here, because it might be a destructive relationship that's come because of a lack of sharing of faith. However many baptism certificates can be produced, and it may not be leading to a peace. It may not be a cross that's saving. Everyone may be wilting in this situation. And you will realize as a priest, you've often got to just rescue people from it and give them the courage to leave it, which is very hard if you've never been alone in your life, because they're being destroyed. Now, I'm not saying it's up to the priest to make the judgment. I'm certainly not saying that. But someone's got to help a person realize that they're not outcasts because they've been divorced or divorced. Divorce is not a sin. Divorce may be, but it isn't necessarily sin.